here in Australia, of course, live on the world's largest island, the island continent. So the idea of life surrounded by water is familiar to us. I think most of us can relate to these lyrics.
I come from the salt water people. We always live by the sea. Now I'm out here west of Alice Springs. We go away. And a family, and my island home, my island home, my island home is waiting for me.
The Wurrumpi Band classic there, My Island Home. Yes, islands, they really appeal, don't they? It's a place to live, a place to visit. We dream of islands for holidays, white sand, azure seas, palm trees, hammocks, pina coladas. We explore nature on wild islands like the Galapagos. Defence forces, however, see them as places to fortify. Witness the Chinese turning reefs into military bases in the South China Sea, which has had no small influence in Australia deciding to acquire nuclear-powered submarines this week. But for centuries, humans have been depositing material so as to build new islands for a range of reasons, making new real estate, a practice that is continuing apace into this century, even as other islands are disappearing. Now, Alistair Bonnet is my guest tonight. He's a professor of social geography at Newcastle University in the UK. He is fascinated by islands. He recently published a book called The Age of Islands, In Search of New and Disappearing Lands. The book examines why new islands are being built at an unprecedented rate for tourism or territorial ambition, while at the same time many islands are disappearing because of climate change. And Alistair joins us now from the UK. Hi, Alistair.
Hi, Suzanne. Thanks for having me.
So what began this fascination with islands for you?
Well, I think a lot of children are fascinated with islands. A lot of children, I certainly did, draw little islands, little fantasies, places you can imagine escaping to. Although actually, I got to know as a child that off the coast of Essex, where I lived, there was a guy who got himself aboard an old World War II gun platform and declared it an independent country, independent from the UK. And he called it Sealand, and he called himself the Prince, and all his family got royal titles. And so it became a little separate micronation, still there, actually, Sealand in the English Channel. And I thought, wow, that's amazing. You can have your own country. Islands just have so many possibilities.
Do you know, I was just thinking too, I mean, I read a lot of Enid Blyton as a child. Some of her, you know, the first book of the Famous Five, George owns her own island, which is out in the little harbour. There's adventures on the island. The pirate books that children read, you know, the treasure is always buried on the island. So they're there in our subconscious, really, aren't they, from quite a young age?
They really are. I was so jealous of George. I can't believe how privileged that little gang were. Having their own island to get to and having their own adventures. Yes, I mean, Treasure Island is the kind of like children's text, isn't it? And it's based upon an island. And it's not just a story. It's about that map, you know, that way of sort of like drawing it and fantasizing through the cartography.
Now, you say in the first page of your book that what is happening to islands is one of the great dramas of our time, and it's happening everywhere. I think most of us think of peaceful paradises when we think of islands. So what is the drama?
Well, the drama is that islands are disappearing, particularly low-lying islands in the tropics because of sea level rise. And at the very same time, what we're doing, we're building lots of low-lying islands in the tropics. So what is going on with the human species in 2021? I don't know. There's something about this fascination with islands. We can see that they are in danger, but at the same time, we just want to keep producing them. There's a real conveyor belt of islands being poured off into the seas at the moment.
A conveyor belt being poured off, you mean disappearing or the ones that are being created?
Well, I'm really there getting at the ones that are being created. I mean, around the coast of China, I mean, you mentioned the Spratlys, but other coasts of China around the island of of Hainan, for example, China's Hawaii, there's all sorts of leisure islands being produced there, similar to the ones that you see around Dubai.
So you write how in 1516, Thomas More set his satire Utopia on an island, that the king in the book made the island by cutting a channel because such a society had to be on an island. What is it about islands and how they represent this sort of chance of hope or perfection?
Yeah, that's right. Thomas More in Utopia, famously about an island, but not many people realise it wasn't an island. King Eutropius made it an island, because he wanted a perfect society. He wanted a society which he could completely control and which every aspect was like under his view. And there's something about islands, particularly small islands, not islands the size of Australia, but particularly small islands, which is all seeable and perfectible.
So you've had a look into this. I mean, you talk about another geographer come poet, Jay Appleton, who devised something he called prospect refuge theory regarding islands. Tell us about this idea.
Yeah, this is the idea that there are certain landscapes that we are just drawn to. And he claimed that we are drawn to them because they're places of security and they're places where we can see danger approach us. And this is why we like mountains. We like the idea of like running up the mountain because we can be safe and we can see all around us. But we also, he said, like islands. And he said these are really deep-seated kind of atavistic psychologies at work here, not particularly rational. We just are inbuilt to be drawn to these particular landscapes. And of course, islands are very safe locations, particularly small ones. And they're locations where you can sort of see everything and you know everything and you feel that nothing's going to leap out at you. Although islands could be places of terror and horror as well.
So how many islands are there in the world? This is a figure that I think is going to shock a lot of people.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I've got the number. I've got it in front of me. It's 680 billion.
Billion. Billion.
Yes, 680 billion. And where did I get this authoritative number? Well, in inverted commas, I got it from the Island Studies Reader, because as it turns out, there's a whole academic subdiscipline today called Island Studies. And so I sort of got interested in this area, of course. And in the kind of textbook for this area, they make this claim. But then I tried to ascertain where they got this number from. And for the life of me, I don't know. But nevertheless, it's there. It's academically authorised, 680 billion. I mean, it raises the question, what is an island?
I was about to ask you that. Yeah. Is it just a rock in the poking up in the sea? Does that qualify?
Well, if it's still poking up at high tide, then I think that's how you get to 680 billion. However, it doesn't really do it for me. Actually, the Scottish census used to have this definition of an island, which is that anywhere above high tide where one sheep can graze. That used to be the Scottish definition of an island. So if you can stick a sheep on it, just the one, and it's happy, then you've got an island. So what is an island? I mean, it has to be above high tide, and a lot of people say it has to support plant and animal life. But most rocks do that. So it's anyone's guess.
All right. Well, we will just trust the people at the Island Studies Reader for now, I think. How many islands did you visit in the course of writing your book?
Oh, a lot. The thing about islands is when you get to one, there's normally another one, just within, just over the horizon or very, very, very nearby. This is the thing. You get to one and you immediately start thinking, oh, I must get to another one. Because normally islands are arranged in archipelagos. So I have dozens, not more than that. I wasn't going crazy. I don't think it's not hundreds, but just dozens of islands, yeah. And they're all very different. I mean, some of them were disappearing and quite a lot of them were new, brand new, minted, freshly made, constructed sort of Frankenstein islands.
Wow. All right. Well, I'll ask you about those a bit later on. My guest is Alistair Bonnett, who's a professor of social geography at Newcastle University in the UK. He is the author of The Age of Islands, In Search of New and Disappearing Lands. I might just say hi to Mandy.
Hello, Susan. How are you?
Good. Now, you want to tell us about one of your favourite islands.
Oh, God, yes. I've been to New Caledonia, Nova Caledonia, and also Bali, but they're just nothing compared to I fainted, hit my head, and had amnesia. And my parents took me straight to Papeete, and then we caught a plane to an island just off Tahiti called Moorea, and it was heaven. It was perfection. It was aqua waters. It was, you felt like the water was higher than you, which is really interesting because of what you're saying. And it was just magical. It was, and there were French people, handsome French men, and white sand and turquoise water. I want to go back. Thank you.
All right. So of all the islands of the world, it's Tahiti that Mandy fell in love with. Thank you, Mandy. All right, nice to hear from you. Now, I've got another, this is Sammy in Melbourne, who says, I fell in love not just with an island but with an archipelago when I went on a school trip to Yogyakarta, Indonesia at the age of 16. I went on to learn Indonesian at uni, went on another trip to Sulawesi, met an Indonesian man. Now I teach Indonesian at a high school. My love for my second island home runs deep, says Sammy in Melbourne. Thank you very much for that. Now, Alistair, let's get to the creation of islands. This is actually by no means a brand new phenomenon. People have been making islands artificially for a long time. How long?
Yeah, it's a really interesting history and not much known. People have been making islands all around the world for thousands of years. It's extraordinary because it's an awful lot of work making an island. And yet, in many lagoons and shallow seas, the little lump that you're seeing is actually an artificial, humanly constructed island. And actually, I start the book going off to some of these islands in Scotland, in a place called Loch Awe. And like a lot of Scottish lochs, it's got a little bunch of heaped stones, rather sort of forbidding islands scattered all over it. But I did know, my boat ended up on one of these, trying to find some remains. So all of these islands were actually made by people between 2,500 years ago and 600 years ago, which begs the obvious question, why would you go to all this effort?
What's the answer?
What is the answer? Yes, the answer, I think, actually comes down to the fact that travelling by water is actually a lot easier than travelling across land, especially in hilly or mountainous or jungly terrain. So the real main street, the highway in the Scottish Highlands was the waterways. So if you could get onto the waterway and have your family den there, you were on the front street. And these islands were also places of safety and security in places where there was a lot of danger from animals and other people. You knew you could have a good night's sleep on one of these places. It's extraordinary, though. They are just unmarked. Nearly all of them are unexcavated. They're just part of the landscape for people all over the world. It's about time we started paying attention to this ancient history of island building.
And the Dutch were doing it in a big way in the 1500s. Tell me about what they were up to.
Yeah, the Dutch have been doing it a big way for a long time, and they are still doing it. If you want to build an island, whether you're in China or the Gulf States, you call up a Dutch company, and they'll come and fix it up for you. What they started doing was enclosing lagoons and shallow seas and turning them over to farming land. So the Dutch, they started early and they started big. I mean, their islands all very flat and just separated from the mainland by quite small channels. But these polders, as they called them, really extended the size of this small country of the Netherlands. And they also protected the mainland from flooding. So they've been doing it for hundreds of years. And as I say, they're still doing it.
So what materials do they use to make the islands?
Well, usually island building isn't that complicated. It isn't involving anyone could do it. You just have to keep massing on material and have a nice stout wall around it. I mean, the Dutch have also, and they developed this hundreds of years ago, developed a system of pumps. All those windmills that you associate with the Netherlands, what are they doing? They're pumping water, and they've been pumping water for hundreds of years, keeping these lands dry, because a lot of the ones in the Netherlands are actually below sea level. It isn't that hard. And a lot of the modern islands that we see being built today are just a question of people scraping up seabed and dumping it on a reef, or sometimes just a shallow area, and then just keep on dumping this stuff until you get an island. Then you kind of secure it, and very often people then just spray concrete over the thing. Hey presto, you've got an airstrip or a residential property.
Gosh, so no particular material, just whatever you want to dump out there, we'll end up able to do
one island. Much. Well, usually you have to bang it down. You want to kind of like press it down, but it's not a particularly complicated technology. But of course, these days we can do it on a much bigger scale than they could hundreds of years ago. And we can do it almost in rougher seas. We can do it in parts of the world where you wouldn't expect this sort of technology to be taking off. So, it's something that's very much within our grasp. The question is, do we want to be doing this? Do we want to be building lots of shallow islands at this particular moment in time?
And I do want to talk more about that. I do want to go to Tim, who has been to one of the islands I would love to go to, one of the real off-the-beaten-track ones. Hey, Tim, where have you been?
I've been to the island of St. Helena in the South Atlantic Ocean, which is after a little island about 10 miles square.
Famous for where Napoleon died.
Where Napoleon died, exactly. Yes, he was there between 1815 and 1821. So the whole story of his exile there has fascinated me from a child, so I eventually got around to going there.
How did you get there? Can you fly there, or do you need to take those sort of long-distance postal steamers?
Well, I went by ship from Cape Town. The RMS St. Helena sailed from Cape Town to St. Helena, and from there it went down to Tristan da Cunha, then back to St. Helena, and then back to Cape Town. So it was a six-day voyage each way, and then you were on the island for 10 days. But it's a wonderful experience. The ship doesn't run anymore. I was on the third last voyage, which was in in 2017. It's now been replaced by an air service. The British government built an airstrip at some astronomical cost of about £300 million, which had flattened two hills and filled up a valley. So you can only go there by plane now, which isn't nearly as much fun, I'm sure, as going by boat.
Doesn't sound nearly as romantic. Now, Tim, this is an island that I understand is very different to your tropical palms and white sand cocktail kind of island. I mean, the South Atlantic's pretty windy, isn't it? What kind of feeling do you get when you're on St. Helena?
Oh, well, look, it's subtropical. It's a balmy climate, really. It's about 25 degrees to 30 degrees all the time.
Oh, okay. I had the wrong idea about it then.
Oh yes. No, it's the most appealing climate. It's surrounded by cliffs about 500 feet high. And then in the centre of the island, it rises to a peak about 5,000 feet above sea level, Diana's Peak it's called. And the centre of the island is tropical rainforest, and it's lush greenery. You drive on the roads through tunnels of greenery, it's very lush in the centre, but fairly barren on the outskirts. Where Napoleon lived was a plateau, and it was very windy and not very pleasant. But when you're in the interior of the island, it's just lush and very steep and hilly, but the beautiful, beautiful scenery. And you have that wonderful sense of space, because from the cliffs above Jamestown, you can see the curvature of the horizon. You really feel you're totally remote, and it's a wonderful feeling.
Oh, how wonderful. All right. Well, that's pretty good, Tim. I'm impressed. Okay. I'm jealous, in fact. It's been on my bucket list, my kind of, you know, down at about 60th place. But still, thank you very much for your call, Tim. Oh, Ian says, I love Gilligan's Island. I still watch the reruns. It brings back so many great childhood memories. Thank you very much, Ian. St. Helena, Alistair, is that one you managed to get to? Oh, sorry, St. Helena.
No, it is very remote. And a lot of islands are really remote. I think that's part of their appeal. I mean, you get a real sense of achievement getting to any island. And when you've got to one so far away from anywhere, there's a real sense of having done something special.
Yeah. Oh, we just a few weeks ago in one of our history segments were talking about Shackleton rescuing his men from Elephant Island, which just is basically an icy rock stuck up in the middle of the Southern Ocean. That one did not sound like the kind of island that you would want to be stuck on. And Alistair, what kind of ecological challenges are thrown up when we do create new islands?
Yeah, well, a whole bunch. And that's partly because we haven't really thought it through yet. I mean, these islands that are being created, they look beautiful, particularly from aeroplanes. But in many cases, the actual environmental knock-on effects have not been studied. And when I was going to some of the new leisure islands being built off the coast of China, people were always complaining to me that the rivers are silting up, that there's all sorts of debris and rubbish being placed on the shore now, that the flow of the water around the coast has slowed right down, all these sorts of knock-on effects that people really didn't think about. And of course, there's the obvious one, what you build this island out of. And usually people build it out of scraping up the seabed, and then you kind of grind up all that seabed into a kind of paste, and then you just sort of squirt it into the place where you want your island. And that is a incredibly destructive way of treating our marine environment. Very little of the marine environment really survives after that. It's not just the grinding up, it's the fact that you create all this debris and microparticles in the water. So it's unfortunate.
Yeah. Practically, can you build an island in only in relatively shallow water?
Well, practically, yes. I mean, that's where you'd be best advised to do that. You know, shallow seas, lagoons, maybe slow-flowing rivers, this sort of thing. But you can build floating islands, and people have been building floating islands for many hundreds of years.
In fact, the reed islands in Lake Titicaca was it Peru, are a good example of
yeah,
that.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, in the Andes bordering Andean countries, you find Lake Titicaca, and the Uros people have been building reed islands for hundreds of years. They did that to escape malevolent tribes. They're really places of safety. And over recent decades, they've kind of like hauled them closer to the shore because they're tourist attractions now. And that group of people make their living by tourism mainly. So that's why they've brought their islands close so you can get on them and experience the fun.
So are there any rules around building islands? You know, look around the world, it seems that every country seems to think, okay, well, if I want to build an island in my territorial waters, seems like I'm perfectly entitled to do so.
Well, you are, yeah. Yeah, I mean, and actually building an island in disputed territory is even more to your advantage because from every little bit of island, you get 200 nautical miles of additional national territory. So it's a great idea if you really want to expand your territory, and this is what China's doing at the moment in the South China Sea, to build up islands, secure them, make sure that they're kind of de facto recognised, and before you know it, you've massively expanded the territory of your country. So it's a bit of an arms race at the moment. Where China is going, I think other countries may follow. And international law is a bit rather lagging behind. What international law needs to do to get all legal, just for a moment, is to stop giving people 200 extra nautical miles from every island that they can build off their shores.
Well, presumably, once you've got an extra 200 nautical miles, that's yet more territory that you can build another island into, expanding sort of ever outwards.
Good point.
Yeah, now I must say I've got some audio here, because once the Chinese settle down on these islands, they do not like other people coming within a cooey of them.
A foreign military airplane, you are approaching my military security ear. Please go away quickly in order to run documents.
This is Chinese level. Please go away quickly in order to avoid long judgment. You are operating my military security air. Please go away quickly in order to avoid long judgment.
Yeah, that's just some of the kind of, you know, warnings that go on in the South China Sea when other countries get close to these islands. So that's, you know, and so what China's basically just got away, you know, just being able to do this, and there's nothing that anyone can do to stop them from building up these islands. Is that correct?
Yeah, it does tend to work in this sort of de facto way if people can sort of make the claim. However, it's not a recognised claim, and all the other countries around the South China Sea also claim the South China Sea. Unfortunately, as the kind of years roll by, the fact that China's in there and it's got most of these islands means that it becomes a de facto reality on the ground. It's not the only country, though, that has built military islands in the South China Sea. I mean, actually, the one you can get to is the one built by Malaysia, Langyang, I think it's called. It is just a runway, really. It used to be a beautiful reef, but you can go and visit there and dive in the what remains of the reefs around Malaysia's artificial islands. So it's not just China. But China is obviously the big player.
Now, I want to talk to Julie, who says she actually lives on a man-made island. Hi, Julie.
Yes, it's not an exotic island like you asked for people to phone in about. I live about an hour's drive south of Perth in a place called Mandurah. Mandurah is on the Indian Ocean, and there's a bay, Manjar Bay, and then to the south of that is where I live. And one side, I'm surrounded by the Indian Ocean. To the south, by the Dawesville Cut, which was put in, it's a channel that was put in about 25 years ago to clean out the estuary, which is on the east. The estuary is the Peel Harbour estuary, and it's about 2.5 times bigger than Sydney Harbour, but it's quite shallow. And at the northern end, at Manjar Bay, there are two bridges to get onto this island, which is about 14 kilometres long and roughly between 3 and 5 kilometres wide. And then there's another bridge at my end, which goes over the Dawesville Cut.
Right. So when you say it was artificially made, Julie, was it that cutting of the channel which made it into an island?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, because at one end there was water. And the bridge is coming on, and that's what made it into an island. And when the channel was put in, there were also canals put in, and within the canals, there was a little island, which is just across the road, more or less, from me, and it was inspired by the Port Grimaud development on the French Riviera. It's quite unique. Living here. So the Indian Ocean, the cut brings lots of dolphins, especially in breeding season. They come in and they teach the calves how to swim and how to catch fish. We've had whales coming into the channel, and the estuary, we have all sorts of bird life. It's just beautiful.
The oh, I think that sounds exotic enough for me, Julie. I think you're selling it. Oh, wonderful. All right, well, so there's Julie calling us from her island home. And Alan in Brisbane, what happened to you on an island recently?
Good evening, Susan. Yeah, so this was only about a month ago, maybe 6 weeks. I got a brand new little outboard and I wanted to test it out on my boat. And I live in Brisbane, so I drove out there. I think it was Redlands where I went. And there's an island called Coochie Mudlow, maybe half a kilometre from the mainland. And I ventured out there. It was quite choppy and blowy, but I got out there, had a walk around, didn't really fish or anything. I'm walking along back to my boat, and I spot on the ground what looks to be the dome-shaped lid of a Slurpee cup. You know the dome-shaped lid they have? I'm thinking it's one of them, and I thought, oh, well, I'll pick it up and take it back. I reach down and pick it up, and it's a glass jar, like a sugar jar.
Ooh.
And it had like a wooden lid on it, and it had been sealed up with candle wax. So it filled up with water, and there was a message in it. So I just threw it in my boat, took it home. Okay, I think later that night I opened it up in the laundry, tipped the rest of the water out, dried it up. There was two names on it, little love letter from a young couple, and it took me about 2 days on Facebook and that to track them down. And, yeah, it was a young couple that put a little message in, threw it in the ocean at Coochie Mudlow, probably on a day trip, and then I came along about a month later and picked it up.
Okay. So it hadn't been there for 100 years or anything. It was actually pretty fresh love.
Yeah. So I've dried up their letter, put it in a little clip seal bag, put my own one in there with my details and a bit of rice to suck up the moisture if any gets in, sealed it up with silicone and bitumen paint, which I use on my boat trailer, so hopefully it's better. But it's kind of, listening tonight, it's making me think I'm a bit slack because I've got to get out there and throw it in again and I'll send them some photos. But, yeah,
Oh, that's a great island story, Alan. Thanks so much for ringing in with that one. Alistair Bonnet is with us, Professor of Social Geography at Newcastle University and author of The Age of Islands in Search of New and Disappearing Lands. Now, Alistair, I want you to tell us about the world which is off the coast of Dubai, which just sounds utterly ostentatious.
Yeah, it really is. So if you fly over Dubai, you'll see it out of the window. There's a map in the sea made of 300 sand islands. And, it's a pretty good map. I mean, sort of Egypt, you can say Egypt's above Sudan and Sudan's next to Ethiopia. You know, so most of the countries do pretty well, with the unfortunate exception of the large ones. And Australia falls into that category. So things go a bit loopy around Australia and New Zealand. Russia and Canada are broken up into tons and tons of islands, but actually it does quite well from a distance. It doesn't do quite so well when you get really on the ground amidst these great big sandy humps. Most of them were supposed to be developed for multimillionaires as sort of like toys or play islands, so they'd have their incredibly expensive villas there and live their little fantasies, but that hasn't really worked out. And it turns out that the pockets of the ultra rich aren't that deep. And so there's only two are actually kind of finished. But if you make the boat over to Lebanon, which is one of the finished ones, like I did, you will see over in the distance that there's a lot of activity going on. Denmark, Sweden, an island called Venice. They're all got lots of cranes on, and they are building huge complexes for honeymooners. Basically, the islands, from being resorts for a few millionaires, are now being redeveloped as sort of destinations for mass tourism. So there is light at the end of the tunnel for the world. Anyway, it sounds completely mad, but it wasn't as mad as the universe. Because that was the original plan, that the world would be encased in the universe, which was like swirling planets and all sorts, just, taking lunacy to new levels.
My goodness, just excuses for rich people to spend money by the sounds of it. These things obviously use a lot of sand, and I'm aware that sand is actually growing increasingly scarce across the world. In fact, I think there's a sand mafia that is in existence. So none of this can actually be good for the environment at all.
Yes, that's right. A lot of those islands are built from sand, and generally it's not just actually the building, it's all the concrete that is required to build all the ultra-star hotels, which are built on islands. So they are soaking up this precious resource. Unfortunately, you can't use just any old sand in concrete. And it has to be a particular fine quality. And that type of sand is increasingly rare. And as you say, it's being smuggled. There is a quite dangerous trade in it. And it also means that some islands that are just composed of this type of sand are actually disappearing. They're being dug out, shipped away. This is happening in Indonesia, shipped away to provide the concrete for the building industries in other parts of the world.
So let's talk about the opposite of island building, and that's the disappearance of islands. Are rising sea levels actually making islands disappear already?
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of islands which have gone. And in the Pacific, I mean, quite a few of the Solomon Islands have gone. And in my journey, which was across the world looking at islands, I came across this refrain again and again and again. And I don't think it's actually as widely reported as it might be. For example, when I was off the coast of Panama on the Caribbean side with some local sailors, they were saying, this all used to be islands. That used to be an island. That used to be an island. And yet that story isn't in the press, it's not reported, it's just local knowledge. So I think the disappearance of islands is actually far more widespread than people think it is.
Yeah, I guess, Alistair, it's when we come to this definition of an island, isn't it, that we're not not necessarily talking about islands that people are living on?
Oh, yeah. No, when I'm talking about the ones off Panama, I'm talking about places that people lived on. Yeah.
Oh, right, they did in Panama.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, Panama's got a whole bunch of islands off its Caribbean side where the indigenous people used to live. Well, they still do. They still live on the remaining islands. They're called the Kuna. And when I went to the remaining islands, they were saying every winter the water comes right over our islands. I mean, it's not just up to the shore. It goes right over the islands, and people were, jabbed at their knees. So it comes up to the knees. And so they're having to evacuate. Their evacuation plans... Well, I call them plans. They're not really plans. They just got to leave, and they have to go to the jungle, which is the mainland of Panama. And it's not very tempting for them. They've lived on these islands for hundreds of years, and they are disappearing around them. So it's a story, and it's kind of story you find only by going to places and talking to people. So island disappearance is very real.
I guess the other thing is that there are some islands that do pop up only for a short time anyway. There are some islands that have a very short natural life cycle, aren't there? The ones that maybe pop up as the top of a volcano and get eroded away before they've really had time to get established.
Yeah, well, the history of the world is of continuous island formation and island disappearance. They come, they go. And there are some spectacular ones that pop up every now and then. From volcanic ridges like Surtsey near Iceland, and then Hunga Tonga. Tonga in the South Pacific is a really volcanically active area, and islands are often coming and going, and they've got one there at the moment, which has been called Hunga Tonga. Came along with huge explosions in 2014, several kilometres wide, and people thought it would disappear, but actually it's still there.
Actually, I think we've talked about that island. I think NASA scientists all raced over it because there was something really interesting there that they wanted to have a look at.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I was so annoyed by that because I tried to get there and as it turned out, it was like one of the many failures that I recount in my book, because often trying to get to islands means you set off, but as I tried when I was going to Hunga Tonga, the sea was too big, there was a storm, it was awful. And so I never got there. And then I read in the press like a few weeks later, all these NASA scientists all landed there in this massive boat. And anyway,
Only you'd know, maybe you could have hitched a ride with them. Let's talk to Charlie in Melbourne, who's given us a call. Hi, Charlie.
Good evening. All this talk about islands and saltwater, I'd like to talk a little bit about the largest freshwater island in the whole world.
Oh, what's that?
The name of it is Manitoulin, and it's in one of the Great Lakes in Ontario in Canada. And every summer I used to go through it on my way to somewhere else. It's and not only it's the largest freshwater island, it's a lot of it is rock. And it gets the same season, the winters, the summers, the springs, and has farms on it. And would you believe it, this island, which is already on an island, has within itself its own island.
Oh, really? Wow.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And of course, you can get to it now either by they built a train over the nearest part of it, so it's close to the mainland. But it has the Northern Ontario bush, lots of pine trees, and the four seasons, winter and spring and snow in the winter. And there it sits, and nobody knows anything about Manitoulin Island, which is, again, the largest freshwater island. It's hundreds of miles from saltwater.
Wow. I've never heard of it, Charlie. It sounds like a special place, though. Thank you so much. Alistair, have you got a favourite after all of the ones that you visited?
Well, actually, going off 40 miles west of the end of England, you get to the Scilly Isles. And the Scilly Isles is somewhere I've never been to before until I started researching this book. And they are just a little bit of paradise. Tiny, tiny places, but just so rich in flowers and also ancient archaeological remains. I mean, I don't know how people used to get out there and build these huge megaliths, but they did. And I remember that very fondly. I was with my daughter, and it's always nice to go to an island with somebody, and then you can share your excitement.
I have to say, I read the intro to your book, and it sounded like your daughter, who was a cranky teenager at the time you set out, wasn't actually overly impressed with your island obsession.
No, she said that I was just trying to globalise my male menopause. That was her phrase. And so I thought, oh, I'm writing that down.
Well, it's a good line, definitely. So of all the islands that you haven't visited, which are top of your list?
Well, there's some great ones. Actually, you mentioned Tahiti. I've never been to Tahiti. I love that sense of, like, you know, you've got French food, you've got a tropical island. I mean, what a great combination. There isn't really an island I don't want to go to. They are just all appealing, in even the cold, bleak ones around Britain, in their own strange way.
Now, you know, while we're talking about, so far you've painted us a picture of building artificial islands that tends to be bad for the environment and usually sort of indicative of greed or territorial expansion. Is there some thinking that we can build islands that do work with nature and can be considered sustainable?
Yeah, I hope so. Because if you go to the Netherlands, and it is often a good place to go if you want to look for innovative island thinking, they are rewilding quite a lot of their artificial islands. And on Flevopolder, the world's largest artificial island, I mean, it's like 16 times the size of Manhattan. Manhattan is an island as well, of course. Anyway, huge. And the Dutch have decided that they're kind of fed up with just sort of geometric fields, that they want nature to be let back in. So they've rewilded a huge part of Flevopolder, and it's full of this wild cattle and, goats and horses. And people go there on holiday now and get back in contact with nature. So extraordinary, a place dragged out of the sea and then rewilded, kind of like returned to nature.
Sounds amazing. Now, speaking of coincidences, Uncle Gavin, who is the uncle of Pat, who writes the Nightlife Challenge, which is an iconic quiz, Alistair, just for your information, says his cousin owns a property on Manitoulin Island, which we were just hearing about from Charlie's. There you go. I'm going to tell you, I've been really thinking, Alistair, about what my favourite island is, but I think I've figured out one of my favourite ever island experiences. Tiny little island just off the north coast of Normandy. Couldn't tell you what it was called. But when I was staying there, there was a band that was playing on this very small island. But the trick was that you had to walk across at low tide. You had the concert and then you had to get back while the tide was sort of starting to come in. So maybe you had to take your shoes off. It was in the middle of summer and sort of walk through the incoming tide. But of course, you had to make sure you were back before the tide fully came in. But it was a lovely little concert that you could only attend at low tide. So I think that might be one of my favourite island experiences. How about that?
That sounds great.
Yeah. Well, Alistair, thank you so much for joining us to give us an insight into the world of islands and the building of artificial islands. It's been really interesting talking to you.
Oh, thanks. It's been fun.
That is Alistair Bonnett, who is a professor of social geography at Newcastle University, author of The Age of Islands in Search of New and Disappearing Lands. Marie in Manly says, while overseas travel is so limited, maybe people in Queensland could visit St Helena Island off Brisbane. She says it's steeped in history. The day picnic tours, the night ghost tours have been, they've been cut back, have they? All right, Marie, so maybe now, or maybe you can wait till they came back. Oh, GT says, in 2003, I visited South Georgia Island, located in the Great Southern Ocean, containing abandoned whaling stations, where Shackleton is buried in a simple grave. Wow, South Georgia Island, I think, also played a role in that amazing story about Shackleton rescuing his men off Elephant Island, which was something that we talked about in This Week in History a few weeks ago, which was just an amazing story. Thank you so much.